Hi, this is Brock Romanek, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. I'm here today with Gary Zani, who is the founder of the Pros and Cons, which is the world's only speakers bureau that has white-collar criminals involved, and it's a speakers bureau devoted to preventing fraud. A very interesting website, so I encourage you to go ahead and check out what Gary has put on his site. Gary, what is your speakers bureau, and what's its purpose?
Well, the purpose of the Speakers Bureau is to keep people out of trouble from the scandals we have seen all down through history, you know, fraud and theft and embezzlement, particularly the corporate reporting, the financial statement fraud is very cyclical. It comes right after a booming stock market crashes, and then everybody gets concerned that they're losing their investment, and so they start looking under the rocks. And when you look under the rocks and you've done stuff you shouldn't have done during the good times, it's going to come back to haunt you. And people, we have very short memories. And so the purpose of the website and the Speakers Bureau is to say, you know, don't make the same mistake that we did. We were, you know, lifelong, honest businessmen, and we got between a rock and a hard place, and we did something we shouldn't have done. And we couldn't turn around, and we paid the price. We had to go to jail, and about 85% of white-collar criminals end up losing their families, and that's the really sad part of this.
And how do you go about procuring speakers who have committed frauds?
Typically, what happens is that they will get in touch with me, and every time there's a feature article on us in the Wall Street Journal, or the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the AP just did an article on us about 2 weeks ago, and it was published in 50-some-odd newspapers around the country and Business Week and Forbes. And every time there's a major article, white-collar criminals, ex-cons will see it, and they'll say, gee, I'd like to help somebody avoid the mistakes that we have made. So I do not go out and contact ex-cons and ask them if they want to be speakers. The first step is, they have to contact me, and that way I know that they're willing to do it because they voluntarily got in touch with me. If I went out and said, be a speaker, and their parole officer said, yeah, you need to be a speaker, and they don't want to do it because it's really embarrassing, they wouldn't do a good job because their heart's not in it. So basically people have to volunteer to do it.
And do the speakers typically actually even address their own crimes?
That's the primary thing that they talk about. If they're doing a two-hour conference presentation, probably 75% of their presentation time is going to be on their fraud because it's personal to them and they bring a lot of passion to it, about how the company was going bankrupt and they were trying to save the company, or they were trying to get the bank loan renewed and the current financial results weren't good enough to get that done. Or, for example, I've got a speaker by the name of Terry Lynn Norwood, and she stole $18,000. She was an accounts payable supervisor, and she had to pay medical bills for their kids. So there's 99% of the time there's something significant, and we call that a pending event. In other words, they're not going to be able to accomplish the pending event with the financial results or their current income, and so that becomes the driving force for the behavior, and they talk themselves into it that they'll fix it if they can just get that bank loan renewed or pay the bills for the medical bills for their kids, and so they're not stealing the money, they're borrowing it, and somehow they'll figure out how to pay it back, and of course they can't, and that's when the whole world blows up on them.
Now, I noticed you do a bit of speaking yourself on your website.
Right.
You have a list of courses. I'm particularly curious about the one that's listed regarding SAS 99. That's a hot topic still for our audience here. What is that program about?
Well, the easiest way to explain SAS 99, and SAS stands for, is SAS and stands for Statement on Auditing Standards, and the easiest way to explain it is everybody's familiar with Sarbanes-Oxley that was passed in the wake of Enron and WorldCom and Arthur Andersen blowing up. And, of course, Sarbanes-Oxley applies only to publicly traded companies, their auditors, et cetera, et cetera. SAS 99 is like Sarbanes-Oxley for everybody else. And Statement on Auditing Standards apply to any entity and their auditors that are getting an audit done. Any entity is getting an audit. And so, in other words, the status of the entity, whether it's public, private, government, nonprofit, your partnership, whatever, is the status of the entity is irrelevant. The trigger for the application of SAS 99 is, are you getting an audit? It doesn't make any difference whether it's General Motors or the corner hot dog stand. If you're getting an audit, this audit standard applies. And what most people don't understand is that the world has radically changed in the last two or three years. And SAS 99, although it's not brand new, it's been around for about 15 years, SAS 99 requires auditors to plan and perform the audit to have a reasonable assurance of detecting material fraud. In other words, the common sense way to explain that is that auditors now have a positive, affirmative duty to detect fraud. They can't say it's not their job anymore.
And I want to remind everyone that something I blogged about, this Huntington Bank shares action at the SEC Enforcement Division brought a few weeks ago, really drives home how the amount of an error really doesn't matter much. It's the SEC is really looking at qualitative materiality these days, and that case really drives it home. So I encourage you to either look at our July issue of eMinders or look at my blog for Huntington Bank shares, do a search.
Brock, that's a really interesting point, because Huntington Bank shares is right here in my hometown.
Yeah.
That whole point you're talking about, a number doesn't have to be big in order to be material.
Right.
The easy way to explain that is a number can be material because of what it accomplishes. So, for example, if a company that borrows money from a bank has $1 million requirement as a covenant to get the bank loan renewed, and they take the first pass at the income statement, and they've only got, let's say, $980,000 of income, and so they need another $20,000 in that magic $1 million number, and so instead of putting $100,000 in the bad debt expense, they only put $70,000 in. Well, the bottom line just went up by $30,000. And so that $30,000, even though size-wise it's insignificant, the $30,000 insignificant number becomes material because it accomplishes a material purpose, a material event, which is getting the bank loan renewed at the current interest rate as opposed to having to renegotiate it at a higher rate because things aren't going well. And one of the things that auditors in particular and business people in general don't understand is, you're absolutely right, it's not just the size of the number, it's what does it accomplish makes it material. And that was codified in Staff Accounting Bulletin 99 that came out, I think it was in 1998, after Arthur Levitt, chairman of the SEC, gave a presentation at the Stern School of Business at NYU.
And let's just give us a brief sense of the other program that I found of interest on your site called Fraud 10 Scariest Cases. What kind of scary cases are discussed during that program?
Well, probably the most interesting case is the ESM government securities case down in Miami, Florida in the late 1980s. That was a case where my speaker, a guy by the name of Nick Wallace, who's on the website, you can go read all about it, a little small government trading securities operation, privately held, had a major customer, a savings loan, that lost over $600 million trading government securities. Goes to ESM in Miami and says, keep half of this loss, $350 million of it, on your books, because if the savings loan records the whole thing, they'd be bankrupt. So this little government trading operation in Miami only has $30 million in capital. So how do you hide a $350 million loss? Answer, you get the engagement partner from the accounting firm to participate in the fraud and set the whole thing up. And the engagement partner at the accounting firm ended up going to prison for 4.5 years.
Wow.
So the moral of the story is, you not only have to watch, if you're an outside accountant, outside auditor, you not only have to watch what's going on at your clients, you have to watch what's going on internally at your firm, no different than a CFO or a general counsel has to watch what is going on inside their company, because we're all human. We all make mistakes.
Yeah.
And that one event, just like Arthur Anderson, that one event, it takes a lot of people to build firm or a company or a law firm or an accounting firm, but it only takes one person to take the whole thing down.
That's great stuff, Gary. I appreciate your time, and I'll definitely keep tabs on what's going on your site as you've got a lot of interesting things there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time, Brock.